Dr. Shlomo, thank you so much for coming online today and spending time for this interview. We really appreciate it. So we start with the questions on the making room paradigm.
Yes.
So my my first question really was that you mentioned in the report about this category, the minority urban category, which are really the countries that are predominantly rural at present. So China,
yes.
India, and clearly one of the biggest challenges of the century is creating efficient cities in these countries. But the a lot of the debate in the urban planning world seems divided on this whole issue of containment versus promotion of sprawl. And so I was just wondering how the making room paradigm sees itself within the context of this debate.
Yes, I think that the containment paradigm, which is largely an import, as far as I'm concerned, from Europe and the United States to developing countries with rapidly growing cities, is misplaced, right? It's a mistake. It's taking the conditions that exist today in the developed countries and thinking that the cities in the developing countries face the same predicaments as the cities in the developed countries. And I think we need to make this division. It doesn't mean that containment is something bad. It just means that it has to be appropriate to the context. And I think the context in places like India is that cities are going to grow in population and they're going to expand and people are going to have more income. And when cities have more people and higher income, they take up more space. And what I mean by more space, I mean a lot more space, not just 50%, but 300%, 400%, 500%, 600%, like they have in the past. So for me, the debate is not really a debate unless it is focused on a place. So when you look at the city that you are living in, for example, you have to figure out how much is it going to grow in population, how much is it going to grow in income, and what are the consequences of that. Now, the other part of this containment debate has to do with densification or increasing densities in cities. Now again, I'm not against increasing densities. I'm all for increasing densities. I'm all for removing restrictions on the increase in densities, which are mostly planning restrictions. They're not market restrictions. If you allow people in Bangalore to build higher and remove the building height restriction, they'll build higher. So I'm all for that. But I think that densification is not an answer to urban population and income growth because it takes a long time. You can imagine how long it takes to transform an area which is built with two or three story buildings to 10 and 12 story buildings. You do it one by one over 20 or 30 years. But as a policy, it's not something that you can replace expansion with. So while you need densification, I don't think that you can avoid expansion. So the idea of the making room paradigm is there's going to be expansion, and your only choice is whether you want it to be disorderly and therefore inefficient and inequitable, or whether you want to think about it and prepare for it and guide it so that it is more efficient, more equitable, more resilient, more sustainable.
So one of the crucial arguments that most advocates of the densification or containment paradigm give is this whole, the environmental benefits of densification. So in that context, Can you shed a little more light on the whole aspect of greenness of the making room paradigm? What are the implications on the environment of the making room paradigm? Especially considering the fact that cities in China and India will have a huge impact on the way global emissions will go in the future.
Well, first of all, I think that connecting emissions to cities is not correct. I think that emissions have to do with people. And when you have a lot of people, and these people become richer, you have a lot of emissions. And this really has nothing to do with cities. So I think that this whole idea of the urban footprint and the kind of ecological footprint, I think this is wrong. I think it's not an urban issue. I think it's a people issue. So if you have more people in India and they have more they have more money and they drive more cars, they're going to create more greenhouse gases. And it has to do with people. It has nothing to do with where they are and where and with cities per se. So I don't think that you can talk about Indian cities as being green or not green. You can talk about India as being green and not green. And if India becomes better off, people are going to have more money, they're going to use more energy, and they're going to use more resources. So in a way, the cities, as Ed Glaser argues, are greener in general than rural areas. They take up less space, they occupy less land, they have a less of an impact on the territory. Because, as you know, cities only occupy 0.5% of the area of countries. So it's not like the cities are the ones that are taking over the planet. They're taking over very small spaces on the planet. Now, there are several aspects to this green argument that have to do with the compact cities. First, that cities, when they expand, take up agricultural land. You know, they occupy land when they expand. Now, cities have always occupied land when they expanded. They need land to expand. And because the land around them is cultivated, for two reasons. First, because they are created in centers of where people are, which are all in the middle of a rural environment. And second, because the area around them is the area that feeds them. So that's the area that's cultivated, because you want to minimize the cost of carrying agricultural goods to the city, so you cultivate the land around them. So when they expand, they take up cultivated land. They've always done that, and they would always do that. And it is true that in India in particular, as the cities expand, there's going to be a tremendous loss of cultivated land. There's no question about that. And this is something that you need to consider, that you need to grow more food, that you might need to import food if you don't have enough food, or you have to make your food production more efficient. But I don't think that that is a reason for not allowing cities to expand. It just means that the rural economy and the urban economy have to work hand in hand, and that you cannot neglect the development of the rural economy and the development of the food supply in India. But I don't think that that merits restricting cities from taking over agricultural land, because they, even though they take up considerable amount of land, the kind of efficiencies and increased productivity that you can have with the rest of the land can more than compensate for the loss of land, for the loss of green land, for the expansion of cities. Now, in terms of pollution, it's not clear to me that overcrowded cities with a lot of congestion in a high density are less polluting than less congested cities with lower densities. So I think that in the India case, you have many cities like Mumbai that are overcrowded, where densities are too high, where you need to open up the periphery in order for the city to be able to breathe, to be able to create conditions for people to live in, which are better than the conditions that they live in now. So Manhattan did that by opening up to the periphery and decentralizing and reducing density. And Mumbai has not been able to do that because there's not enough infrastructure on the periphery to be able to decongest it. So I think that the people, the Greens, tend to celebrate Indian slums. Like Stuart Brand writes about Dharavi and says this is a great example of a green place. I think it's a horrible example of a green place. I think that he completely neglects to mention the overcrowding and the suffering in this place and how better off people are if they could have more space, if they could breathe, if they had some access to green areas. So I think a little bit, this is a little bit hypocritical in my way of thinking. I think that there are what I call sustainable densities. I think that densities in many Indian cities can be reduced to make them more livable, but they don't need to be reduced to American standards. So in that sense, I'm all for opening up overcrowded cities, which I don't think are so green, really.
Sticking with the example of Bombay, if a city like Bombay were to implement the making room planning paradigm, it would require strong sort of governance mechanisms. And you yourself remark in the report that cities in urbanizing countries like India lack strong enforcement and governance mechanisms. So if Bombay were to implement, say, an arterial grid of roads 1 kilometer apart, large and generous metropolitan boundaries, it would require strong governance for the city. Now, I see this as some sort of a contradiction. And I'd like to know your thoughts on how, given the current condition of cities in India with weak enforcement mechanisms, how effective can the implementation of the making room paradigm be?
I think this is a very interesting case because when you compare India to China, you can see that in China, they don't have these restrictions and these political constraints that they have in India. So China is moving ahead very fast in creating urban infrastructure, and India is lagging behind. So India is more creative, is a lot more developed scientifically than and entrepreneurially than China, but it's falling behind and will fall behind more unless the politicians in India wake up to the idea that they have to do something about infrastructure. So they can sleep and they can continue to sleep, but the more they sleep, the more they fall behind. So I think that there is an infrastructure crisis in India that requires rules that will simplify the creation of urban infrastructure and the preparation for expansion. So instead, we're going in the opposite direction, making it more difficult for government to create eminent domain so it can find the area for roads. It's all very cumbersome. There's a lot of corruption. This is untenable. This is a crisis, a political crisis. This is why the Bombay cannot survive for long with this chokehold on its expansion. What it needs is to connect to its periphery. What it needs is a few bridges across the bay, and one bridge to all the development area to the east of Mumbai, and another bridge is being thought about or talked about forever, You need more than two bridges. You need five or six or seven bridges. You need to develop all of this area, and you need to do it quickly. And these people are still dreaming or quarreling. I don't know what they're doing, actually, when they get up in the morning. But they're clearly not doing the right thing. So these, there is an example, you know, my favorite example, Ahmedabad, with a strong chief minister for Gujarat. It plans for the expansion of its periphery and basically creates this arterial grid. So it's not impossible in India. It's just that you need the kind of politicians and the kind of political atmosphere that can make it happen.
So what I'm saying is that a lot of urban planners and policy analysts in India have pointed out that cities have a lot of functional autonomy but lack any sort of financial autonomy, and that they're very much dependent on upper tiers of government like the state government and the national government for funding. So often, as in the case of Ahmedabad, you need someone like a strong chief minister who's leading the state government to plan for the city. And a lot of people are trying to say that large cities are big enough to be administered by themselves. We need a strong mayor for these cities, and more power should be given to city governments. So I'd just like to know, in your experience and in your research, does it say that strong mayors do lead to more efficient cities?
I think that the record on this is mixed. Mayors need to be re-elected, and they have a very short, planning horizon. So, like somebody said to me at the World Bank, the first thing for a good mayor to do, and the easiest thing to do, is collect the garbage. Because in 1 month, the city will be clean. You know, you hire a lot of contractors with a lot of lorries. They come in, they pick up all the garbage. After 1 month, the city is clean. Everybody say, whoa, this is a very good mayor. Look at how clean the city is. That is easy to do. And mayors look for things like that they can do very quickly and get results, right? Mm-hmm. But when you're thinking about urban expansion, for example, we're talking 20 or 30 years getting the land in advance of expansion. This is the kind of vision that requires either a mayor that is obsessed with his legacy, which you know, many, especially the younger ones, are not going to be very keen to think about that. Or you need bureaucrats that are staying there. That's their career, and they're going to do it for a long time. So in some, let's say, research that was done in Colombia, it turns out that when they gave mayors the power, those things that needed to be done long-term suffered. So I think that in terms of long-term planning, I think that the idea of giving mayors the power is a mixed blessing. I'm not suggesting that this is not a good idea. I think that mayors are more answerable to the people than state governments, because they are closer, mm-hmm. and you're likely to get policies that are more sensitive to the electorate in the cities. But in the case that I'm talking about, which is, let's say, urban expansion, you're talking about people who are not there yet and who haven't been born yet and who cannot vote for that mayor. It's the future generations of people who are going to live in that city. So I'm not sure, again, the voters who have a lot of problems now, who want to improve their lives now, who want better services now, are the best group of people that are going to have realistic visions about what needs to be done in the future. So I'm not saying that this is not a good thing, I'm saying it's going to be a mixed blessing.
So, as I said in the mail that I've sent you, so one of the critical components of meeting the urbanization challenge will be to provide affordable housing to households. Now, India seems to be stuck in the whole public housing realm, where the government creates houses and people are moved out into these public houses. Whereas you have previously argued that this paradigm needs to shift to a market-based approach to planning. Now, if you were to think of solving the question of affordable housing in a country like India, what will be the critical components of such a policy? When you say market-led mechanism, what specifically are those components?
I think that government is particularly weak on the supply side of affordable housing. Government can help on the demand side by creating viable mortgage markets, by maybe creating subsidies and loans or taxation systems that help people strengthen their position in the market from the demand side, so that they have something that they can use to improve their houses or to build their houses or to buy houses. Now, on the supply side, the government is very weak. It's very weak in terms of efficient construction. It's very weak in terms of collecting loan payments. It's very weak in terms of buying and acquiring land efficiently, in terms of design, in terms of reading the market, in terms of what kind of houses are desirable. It's very weak on that side, and has usually failed. You know, so that in general, almost all governments, without exception, have moved out of the public housing business. They have either privatized housing, public housing, as in India, or they have moved on to market, as in China or Russia. The only example with a strong public housing regime is Singapore, where 85% of the people live in public housing. But this is such an outlier with such a different economy that, and with no rural-urban migration. So I don't think it's a very good example for public housing. So I think the government has to understand it has to move out of trying to provide housing because it's not good at it. You know, so that is not and has never been a good solution. So it builds a few thousand units, but this is nothing compared to the actual demand for housing in a place like India. So you can make a mark, but it's usually not scaled up properly. So I think that that is fair. So what do we have in its stead? Now, if we go through the kind of the transition from public housing to a more market-oriented housing, if you recall, there was this fashion to do sites and services, which means, you know what, why don't we just give people service sites and let them build their own houses? Well, this again, as far as I'm concerned, is another form of public housing. It just means the government is still engaged in giving individual sites to individual families and still does it very slowly. It takes years to create any one of these projects. And again, it cannot be scaled up. So that has also failed. So what you see when you look around is that most housing is created by markets. Markets, both formal markets and informal markets. And I don't see any alternative to this, might say, paradigm or the way things are located. All that government can do is enable it or make it happen in a more efficient, more economical, and more equitable way. So what I'm trying to talk about is that I think that the most important thing for keeping housing affordable. In a place like India, is keeping land affordable. So what it means is that you create enough serviced land that is accessible to jobs. You allow jobs to decentralize. You allow people to move out. You create modern polycentric cities, which India is very slow at creating, in particular in places like Mumbai, because there is no room for these sub-centers to grow and expand. You know, while cities with the same population in Mumbai would have 12 or 20 such employment centers with people closer to this employment. So what I'm saying is that this whole urban decentralization, which I'm advocating with the Making Room paradigm, is at the heart of affordable housing. What you need to do is open up the land market. Open up the land market so people don't speculate in land, so there's enough land and there's good services that makes this land accessible. So it's not like 2.5 hours from your workplace, but less than an hour or half an hour from your workplace. So I think that unless the planners understand that their role is to enlarge the city, to make it possible for people to afford a plot of land, you are never going to have affordable housing in India.
There's still a lot of skepticism of the market in India. And a lot of the critics still say that if you were to leave the housing issue to the market, you would not see a fall in rental prices, and you'd still have a lot of people out of the ambit of the so-called affordable housing that the market's supposed to create. So in the examples that you've quoted, China and Russia, which have moved away from public housing to market-led models, has the experience been that prices have fallen and housing has become more affordable?
China is interesting as an example because the affordable housing in China is not what the government is building, affordable housing, or the developers are building affordable housing. They're not. The affordable housing in China is in the urban villages surrounding the cities and in the cities, you know, that are not really part of the planning regime of these cities. So all these urban villages around, inside and outside Chinese cities, have plenty of affordable housing. And they have been able to maintain, to provide housing for hundreds of millions of people. And it is market-based housing, and it's villagers basically building apartments on their residential plots and renting them for very affordable rents to the workforce in Chinese cities. So in China, they've had great success with that. And these are not slums. These are basically apartments made of good solid materials with good plumbing, electricity, water supply, and so on, and creating good incomes for the farmers who are doing this, and being done usually without much banking finance. They're a very successful system of affordable housing. So they've solved the affordable housing problem by turning a blind eye to what the villagers in and around Chinese cities do. So that is the China example. Now, when you're saying that the Indians still mistrust the market, I agree with you. They mistrust the market because they've distorted it for so long that that it's really not functional. It's not. It's not a well-functioning market. So when you are kind of pushing, constraining development, making it hard to expand, not providing the infrastructure for expansion, you're going to have land supply bottlenecks. And land supply bottlenecks is what drives the market in the periphery of Indian cities. And you've created it. It's not there. You cannot, you know, ruin something and then complain that it's not functioning. You know, you're part of it. You're the reason that it's not functioning. If you make it functioning, it's going to take years. It's going to take years to create affordable land in Indian cities because the distortions are so great. But that doesn't mean that this is not the only solution to the problem. There is no other solution to the problem.
And one of the most visible manifestations of this distortion is the preponderance of slums in Indian cities. So official data as of 2011 tell us that around 20% of all households in cities live in slums. And this is as high as 42% in cities like Bombay. There's a huge crisis. The classic response from the side of the government is slum evictions and moving the people living in the slums to the periphery of the city. Now, there's a lot of concern that this leads to systematic denial of the right of the city to these people, and this denies their access to their jobs, to their sources of livelihood. And policy has slowly in India started moving towards developing the sites of the slums themselves. Now, we've read with a lot of interest the innovative solutions, especially in Bangkok, where land sharing agreements have led to development of slums. Now, are there similar innovative models that India can use to solve the problem of affordable housing and particularly the problem of slums in Indian cities?
I think that the solution to the slum problem in India is very simple, but that doesn't mean that it will happen. I think that the problem is really one of paternalism. Namely, if you want to solve the Dharavi problem tomorrow, I would simply say, look, the land on which this slum is located now belongs to you. We give up the authority on this land. You are now shareholders in this great economic asset in the middle of one of the most important cities in the world. And the issue would be, how do you derive the maximum benefit for yourselves by developing this appropriately? So it's not like we give it to developers who are going to take advantage of you, or to corrupt politicians who are going to do deals. It's yours. And now the issue is, how do you manage this asset? And believe me, I have no doubt in my mind that when and if this happens, if ever, this housing in Dharavi is going to improve very rapidly into very good housing. What you're doing right now and have been doing for decades is keeping the uncertainty about the future of the place so that people really cannot invest. Because why invest? Because you keep having these plans about what you're going to do. Yeah, let's get rid of this uncertainty and let's create plans where that allow these people to stay where they are and give them ownership and control of the territory. And I think that wherever this has been done, and there are, you know, in neighboring Pakistan, for example, there are very good examples of where this has been done, either marginally or totally. But if you look at, let's say, Orangi, in comparison with Dharavi, there's a lot more development there. Why? Because the government has basically said, this is your land, you own the land, you can develop that land, we're not kicking you out. And the Indian bureaucrats have always insisted that these slums are temporary, that they don't exist, that they need to be, that this is actually, according to the law, in, let's say in Maharashtra, slum land shows up as vacant land in the law. It's not really inhabited. They never recognize that these people are there and are there to stay. So India is really behind in this, because the bureaucrats have so long insisted on keeping these slums in this kind of limbo state where nothing can happen. And also by bringing in the private sector to redevelop the land and again, I really believe that this is a soluble problem, but you just have to let go. You have to tell the people, "You, this is yours, you can stay here. Now let's get serious about how to make something out of it."
I'm just going to go back to one of your early works, the Oregon Experiment. And it's a text that a lot of people in the organization have read with a lot of interest. And really like the idea of saying that people who inhabit built environment are the best know how to design it, best know what to do with it.
That's what I just said.
Yeah.
About the slums.
About the slums.
Yeah.
But the problem is that planning in India is still very, very centralized.
So the, I know.
And people really had no say in the planning of cities. So
I know.
Keeping with the principle of the Oregon experiment, what are some workable ideas to get to the state that you've just mentioned? Because clearly, this idea has a lot will have a lot of political ramifications. They will not like the idea of giving out land titles to people, say, living in Dharavi. So how can, in the meanwhile, in the interim, Indian cities think of creating more participatory cities, more cities, cities that have more organic order, as the Oregon experiment suggests?
Mm-hmm.
And what is the international experience on this?
I think that going back to our discussion about whether mayors should be elected or appointed earlier on, I already mentioned that in places where mayors are elected or where even district chiefs are elected, there is more potential for participation. So the whole decentralization movement is motivated by the need for feedback from the population and the need for participation. And in many cities now, I'm sure you're aware of this, there's participatory budgeting exercises where people can come in and participate on how the budget is going to be spent. And this is becoming the kind of a global movement, this participatory budgeting movement. The Right to the Cities movement that you mentioned before is the same kind of movement, asking for more participation. But I think that the discussion will remain theoretical unless you specify in advance the realm of participation. This is what I'm trying to say, like, what do we want to participate in? It's not like, but you realize, I'm sure, that participation is very costly. It requires people's involvement, they are busy, they don't have the time, and you end up with the wrong people participating, right? The people that have a lot of time on their hands, or the people that have some axe to grind, and the other ones come to the meeting and make a lot of noise, and it's the same people all the time. But the people who really need to participate and really need to voice are never there because they're too busy. They got other things going on. You know, it's like a famous saying by George Orwell, "I gave up socialism when I decided that I had better things to do with my evenings." No, so it's there's a lot of meetings, right? There's a lot of discussion, there's a lot of talking, and nothing ever gets done. So so this whole notion of user engagement has to be a lot more constrained. It's a lot more planned in advance. You know, we need your opinion and your engagement and your involvement on very, very specific things. You know, like, how do we do this? Or, you know, kind of very general very general or very simple ideas. You cannot just get everybody involved in everything. It just doesn't work. So when I'm saying that you could get the Ravi out of its doldrums, what I mean is there has to be a single decision about who decides about the Ravi, right? Once you say the people, it's a completely different agenda than when the government decides or the developer decides about the Ravi. So what I'm saying is all of this user involvement needs to be simplified and needs to be very specific. Just kind of calling for more participation is not a good idea. It's not a good idea, and it can be easily appropriated by the wrong people to do the wrong things.
This is one of the things that we will struggle with, especially in our work on the ground in Srirangapatna. You're aware of the town of Srirangapatna near the city of Bangalore, and we've written to you previously about this, where we're trying to create a 25-year-old vision for the city and the question of how to finance that infrastructure. Are there international examples of such? You talked about the need for specific things that require planning. Participatory budgeting is, of course, one. Are there similar exercises in the realm of planning where people have been involved in the creation of a city? Or is city a very large unit to think of? Should we think of subunits, districts, or particular slums, or particular wards within the cities to plan in?
Look, Mr. Prasad, think about the institution of private property. The institution of private property is precisely this. That says, here's a plot of land, and within that plot of land, you're responsible for planning and designing and doing whatever it is that you need to do, right? And we create this regime, and we create a lot of these plots, so a lot of individuals, or families, or firms, or cooperatives or groups can actually plan and engage in making decisions on how these things happen, right? So this whole idea of dividing the city into smaller realms and saying within this realm you can do whatever you need to do is precisely that participatory environment that you want to create. So that the first element of such a regime is removing unnecessary constraints on what people can do and what with their land, right? With how they can develop their land. They're allowing, you know, kind of removing density constraints, removing height constraints, giving more freedom for people to plan and decide on their own, right? Mm-hmm. So that is like the first building block of participatory regime, right, where it's not a top-down, we tell you what to do and what you cannot do, but you can use your creativity and your information about the market and your desires to create whatever environment you need to create. Now, in the same way, this is happening in the U.S., for example, on a very large scale with, I forget the word, but with these kind of housing communities that can draw their own rules, that can make their own you might say zoning charters or planning charters, and many American communities nowadays are created on this basis. You know, this area is an area that even though people have private properties, they agree to plan together and to agree on together what the rules are for the development of these areas, right? So you start building from the bottom up. So you say, okay, we can have, you could call it cooperatives, but you can have even larger housing associations or neighborhood associations that create their own group, and these are empowered to act. So you have that example. You have another example, which are these business improvement districts in many American cities, where all the businesses in the district agree to pay certain monthly charges for doing certain things with the environment, with street furniture, with cleaning, with take care of homeless people that happen to be there, and so on. So there are quite a number of examples of this kind of organizing for communal actions on a smaller scale, but that creates a larger scale than the kind of the private property scale that we are used to as the kind of basic unit of participation.
In the recent past, there have been the advent of big data and decentralized modes of planning through mobile apps for planning, iPad apps for planning. How do you think these things will affect the future of urban planning itself? Do you think these things will lead to planning becoming more participatory? And there's also this whole movement towards building smart cities, using data from what people are doing to create cities that are more efficient and more smart in that respect. So do you see that as tying in with what you've said as participatory?
Yes, it's hard for me to see where this is leading. I think there's a lot of interesting uses that you can make from this new big data sources, and it's just emerging. You know, so some things that we were not able to do before, we are now able to do in a better way. So I think that we're going to get a lot more feedback about how cities behave and how cities are than we have now. I'll give you a small example. I mean, the municipality has to fix the potholes. You know, they don't necessarily know where the potholes are, but if you had a movement where everybody that sees a pothole takes a picture and that pothole appears with its coordinates on some a picture of a pothole appears on some map, it becomes hard for the municipality to ignore the potholes, right? So if you can imagine people, and the same with streetlights, right? You can, every time the busted streetlight, take a picture of it and put it up on the internet, the government again has to react, you know? So in terms of giving government feedback about its performance or its services is going to be easier. And I think that's going to make a lot of difference. But I cannot really predict how this will go. I think that it's a very good way of increasing accountability from government. Now, it's also going to make planning a little bit more evidence-based than it is now. You know, like right now, a lot of planners collect data, but then they never actually use it to, you know. So, for example, if I'm telling you that if you're talking about affordable housing, then how affordable? Does anybody know how much people are paying for their housing? How much people are paying for their housing in the slums or in the squatter settlements or in the new places? You don't have any information. People are really talking, but they don't know what they're talking about. So I think that this idea of having more information, I think, will make a huge difference for planning in the future. Right now, I find that planning is really not evidence-based. And I have great hope that it will become more evidence-based in the future.
If I could go back to the Oregon experiment once more, we are huge fans of what has happened, and we strongly believe that people who inhabit spaces are the best designers of those spaces. But then we often hear this counter argument to say that no, urban planners who've studied the discipline of urban planning are best suited to plan these spaces. Mm-hmm. Is this, and you see that also being implemented as a force of policy. How do you get these reactions often? And if yes, how do you, what do you say to urban planners who say that they know best what to do?
Well, I'm in complete agreement with you, as you can imagine, and I don't think that the planners know best. And I think that it goes back to what I just said to you, is that planners proceed without evidence. You know, so they're not even listening, or let alone collecting data on what is really happening on the ground. So they're really ignorant and very ideological and bureaucratic about their approaches. And Indian planners are no exception, as you can imagine. I think that much of the decisions that planners have to take are contextual. They have to understand the context. They have to understand the people. They have to understand what they need. I'll give you an example. When I was working in Bangkok on slum upgrading, this is very early on. So I went with a Thai colleague of mine to a slum. This was a slum called Jerusalem Village, a Muslim slum in Bangkok with about 200 families. And we said, well, what do you want to do here? He said, well, we don't have a road. We need a road. If you can get a road that goes to... So we tried to talk to all the landowners around it and try to even get the generals to interfere and try to get a road, but we couldn't. So we went back and said, well, what's the next thing? He says, well, we're very worried about fire because this is all wooden construction and people are cooking on open charcoal stoves, and we're very afraid of fire. So what we need is a fire protection system. So I said, okay, this we can help with. Let's build a fire protection system. There was a canal nearby. We built a pump house and built the pipes through the community. And then there was this discussion one day, and I'm listening, and my Thai, as you can imagine, is not very good, you know, so... And there's this old guy, and he keeps saying something which, like, mango. You know, what about the mango? What about the mango? And I said, well, I know the word mango because I eat a lot of mangoes, but what's that got to do with, you know, with the system? And then I try to find out. And what he's saying is the current location of the main pipe is going through the location of a big mango tree. Right? And if you don't want to destroy the mango tree, you have to move the pipe. Right? And he was the only one that was aware that there was a big mango tree there. Right? Everybody else was kind of looking at maps, you know, drawings and, yeah. So, but how are you going to know that there's a mango tree if you don't get involved with the community? Right? How are you going to do it? How are you going to know this? So this is a kind of a typical example. So what I'm saying is, you can bring technical expertise, and a lot of these planners, architects, engineers, they have the technical expertise, but they don't have the context. They don't understand the context. They don't understand that a lot of things that may be needed in one location are not needed in another. So it's very specific. And so I think that there has to be some kind of a meeting of minds between the experts and the people that are actually living there on the ground. But again, I stress, Mr. Prasad, I stress that this cannot be open-ended participation, mm-hmm. because it's too open-ended, involves too many people, and often involves the wrong people. So what you need is really find the right voices in the community that really have the interest of the community at heart, rather than their own parochial interests, that really have a good understanding of what this community needs, that listen to people, and that can actually articulate their thoughts, because they're not just community members, but they can actually think in community members. So this is a tall agenda. That's what I'm saying, is the requirements on the participants from the community are very substantial. So so that's why I'm saying it has to be very carefully studied, and you have to really find those people that can actually make a difference. Because just kind of saying, well, we need participation is a recipe for failure.
That brings us to the end of our questions. Thank you very much, Dr. Shlomo Angels, for spending close to an hour with us. It's having read The Making Room Paradigm and your work in Bangkok and on affordable housing, it's really an honor for us to speak with you and to do this interview and have it featured on our blog. We hope to continue this conversation with you and to bring you more stories from our participatory planning exercise in Srirangapatna, to get your critical inputs on that also. Thank you very much, Doctor. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Good. Thank you, and I wish you all the best in your work. Take care.
Thank you. Thank you very much.